I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Mark Kingwell joins me again. He's just published his latest book, a marvelous collection of essays about baseball. These are essays that reflect on the sport, attaching sketches of the sport and the action that draws fans in, as well as memories that Mark has about a sport he watches, he's played, and one that has filled his life season after season. I'll get Mr. Kingwell to tell us about some of the essays in this book, as well as the lessons he derives from the game about failure, community, love, people, and life itself. Mark Kingwell is a professor of philosophy at the University of Toronto and a contributing editor of Harper's Magazine. He has authored or co-authored 18 books of political, cultural, and aesthetic theory, including the bestsellers Better Living, The World We Want, Concrete Reveries, and Glenn Gould. His most recent essay collections were 2015's Measure Yourself, Against the Earth, and Unruly Voices, which he was on this program with last in 2012. The book is called Fail Better, Why Baseball Matters. It is published by Biblioasis. Please welcome back to the Planta on the Line program, Mark Kingwell. Professor Kingwell, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
So, the title of the book is Fail Better. Would you explain that for people who might wonder why you've come up with a title when you're discussing this sport?
Well, the phrase itself is taken from a work by Samuel Beckett, The Worst Bird Ho. And the longer version is, ever tried, ever failed, no matter, try again, fail better. And this has become very, very popular in all different kinds of walks of life, maybe not always appropriately. It's a mantra in companies in Silicon Valley, for example. The tennis player Stan Wawrinka has it tattooed on his forearm. That, I think, makes a little more sense. But in any case, it seems to me what Beckett is getting at there is some idea about the nature of our relationship to failure, and especially our relationship to certain kinds of achievement. So he's talking about artworks and the human condition and how we all somehow fail to realize our ideals and certainly to achieve perfection, but we need to embrace that as part of what it means to try in the first place and get better from it. I think it's not as simple as just learn from your mistakes. It's a little bit more than that. It's a genuine commitment to acknowledging that you can't win if you don't play, but you also have to face the possibility of losing if you play. And there's some deep wisdom in that.
Yeah, baseball is a sport where, I mean, the score matters to a lot of people, but the score doesn't tell you the whole story. So you talked a moment ago about art and the reality of human condition. I mean, you see that in every game, or you see that, I should say, in the sport of baseball. You see art and reality.
Yeah, I believe so, and that's part of why I wanted to focus on baseball. Part of it also is a personal attachment that I've had to the game for many years. Yeah, it's my favorite sport, and the reasons are intertwined, because there are features about baseball that are unique to it that make it, I think, especially interesting as a study in failure, but also as a genuine basic philosophical opportunity. So on the failure side, it's obvious that the best hitters in history fail 7 or 6 times out of 10. Hitting a Major League Baseball is considered one of the hardest things in the sport, if not the hardest thing. Errors are so important to the game and its outcomes that they're shown right up along runs and hits. And it's just the game in many ways signifies failure. And I, when I talk to baseball people, it's amazing how many people say that and think about it. So that's not the only topic in my book by any means, but it did seem to be one that was recurring.
It seemed to me that this was a personal book to write, and you just said that a moment ago, because you do reflect on your relationship with the game as well as your relationship with people, your parents, and friends of yours that you watch baseball games with and have in the past. Some are no longer with us. And in terms of some of the playing that you did.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's a game that has a lot of kind of mythic resonances about the relationship between fathers and sons. And I didn't want to lean too hard on that, but you have to acknowledge it. The game of catch and Field of Dreams is something that most people remember. And my mother, who was also a huge baseball fan, still is, but she doesn't get out these days. So those were very important. And the friends that you mentioned, the book's dedicated to three wonderful baseball fans and friends of mine who have all recently left us. And especially in the case of Allison Gordon, who was a very good friend and a great baseball writer, she taught me a lot about the game just because she knew how to watch. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a bit like, I don't know if he actually said it, but the Yogi Berra dictum, you know, you can observe a lot by watching. and that's exactly what she taught me about watching a baseball game. It's sometimes the things that are happening away from the action that are the most interesting.
There's a moment in the book where you're talking about, you were at a game with someone, and you talk about the discussion that you had in the stands, and I was thinking about that a moment ago. What do you like when you go to the baseball park? And because I mean, we know what it's like from I've never been there, but I know from television and from what I've read, just sort of the atmosphere at the Sky Dome there when the Blue Jays play. And you talk about your own relationship in terms of whether you enjoy going to the game amongst the other people that are there, because it can get quite rowdy and people do drink a bit.
Yeah, this is a few funny stories there. The one you started with, I was in Cleveland to give a lecture, and this wonderful colleague of mine said, you know, is there anything you want to do while you're in Cleveland? And I said, well, I want to go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I would love to go to a baseball game. So he produced some tickets, and the two of us went down there. And this was right around the time of the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky scandal when Clinton was being examined. And so he wanted to talk about that whole question of what counts as sex and what the meaning of is. I should say this was a philosophy colleague, so maybe not surprising. Well, all I really wanted to do was watch the game, and I could never say this to him, but I really would have been happier if I'd been there alone, because sometimes that's what I really love to do. It's a game that I can't think of. I mean, I like to watch sports by myself all the time, but a baseball game, for me anyway, it can be a solitary as well as a friendly experience. So I'm not a very talky watcher. Not surprisingly, I'm fairly contemplative, and I like quieter parks. So you know, the second part of your question, the dome for me is far from ideal. There's very little silence. There's a lot of distractions creation of spectacle. And it's funny when, especially the roof is closed, when they go back to the action, the umpire calls time in again after, say, a commercial break or a switchover between innings. The place falls silent in this very eerie way. Mm-hmm. And you realize how loud the music has been and the PA announcement and all the rest of that. So, yeah, I don't love that part. I prefer smaller parks and quieter parks, but can't always get what you want. And I guess I'd rather watch Major League Baseball under subpar conditions than anything else.
How often do you get to a Jays game?
I try to go about 10 times a summer. It's nowadays, especially, too expensive for me to do more than that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's good. If I spread them out over the season, that gives me a little hit every now and then. And beyond that, I love to listen to it on the radio. It's one of my favorite things to do on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, are you doing something while you're listening to the game?
Usually it's something like, cooking or, working in the garden or something like that. Not something where I'm concentrating on something else. Mm-hmm. I don't always like to pay close attention to it, but I like there to be some sense that I'm connecting with it. It's not just, you know, in the background. It's a little more engaged in that. One of my favorite things, I don't do it much anymore, is driving with the baseball game on. My wife and her family have a place that they go to in the summer in New Hampshire, and we try to get down there a couple of times a summer, and that's a fairly long drive. And we just keep spinning the radio dial looking for a baseball game, because that really passes the time, and it really, I don't know, there's something about moving along with your eyes on the road and that in your mind.
There's a piece in the book where you talk about baseball parks, and we've talked about the Sky Dome already, but the one that got a shout-out was the park here in Vancouver, Nat Bailey,
mm-hmm.
which it has a corporate name, which I've conveniently forgotten. how much time have you spent there?
Well, I remember the first time I went there. I've been to Vancouver lots of times. I have family out that way. And I don't know why exactly. I was at a loose end for a couple of days. Nobody else was around. And so I was just actually just tooling around Vancouver looking for things. And I didn't want to go to Kitsilano. I didn't want to go downtown. So I drove into the park, and then I came upon the park within the park, the mm-hmm. baseball park. And a game was just starting. And so I went back 3 days in a row because they had a homestand on and sat right behind the home plate and, had a hot dog for lunch every day. And boy, it was great. That's fine baseball, and it's a really, really nice stadium.
And I've noticed that because we used to do that with the folks at work. We used to go down as a group. And year after year, the park just got... Well, more people were there year after year,
mm-hmm.
and it's something now where we can't go as a group anymore because they're all booked up far in advance. So, have you noticed this across the not only the country but across the continent, that interest in baseball has gone up?
Yeah, I would say so, and that I should say that wasn't my experience because what I was talking about a moment ago happened some years back, and you could just walk up and get the best seat in the house.
Yeah.
You could just walk up to Blue Jays games until just a few years ago, and now it's practically a sellout every game, and ticket prices have gone crazy. I think it's great because I hated to see the idea that or the experience that baseball was losing traction. And there's still some people who think, say, compared to American football, it's not even close. But
yeah.
I don't know. You see a hell of a lot of interest in it, and the Cubs' win last year, their run for the series was riveting for sports fans across North America and everywhere else. And so that's great for the game, even though it does mean that the concession line's longer and it's maybe harder to get a ticket.
Yeah.
Overall, I think it's a good thing.
What you also talk in the book about how baseball is broadcast. We've talked about radio a moment ago, but in terms of television. You mentioned a moment ago about an umpire calling a break, and then because you knew that there was a commercial break going on.
Right.
How has that affected? Because we're also hearing about certain rule changes so that the game is faster.
Yeah. Well, the good thing still about a baseball television broadcast is, except in extraordinary circumstances, they won't break it during a half inning. So you get at least that. It's not like... football or basketball where, you go to commercial practically every 15 seconds.
Mm.
Drives me crazy. And the whole thing about sports on television, I tell this story right going back to Rune Arledge, who was really the genius who understood the kind of McLuhanite future of sports on television. Although I should say that notoriously McLuhan himself predicted that baseball would die out because he didn't take it with... the right kind of spectacle for television. So now television and sports, and at least in North America, are inextricable, not least in the instant replay rule, which, of course, brings the television into the game and rather than just observing the game. And, opening that door in baseball was a disappointment to me and many fans, although when you see the call and they get it right, you got to think that's a good thing. I think about a notorious example, recent example, pitcher Andres Galarraga, who was one out away from a perfect game when Jim Joyce, the first base umpire, blew the call. And the replay clearly shows that he'd blown the call, but it stands as a one-hitter, no perfect game. And that's cruel, and overturning that might be considered more just. But I don't know, there's something to be learned about the cruelty of a bad call as well as getting the call right.
Yeah, the frailty of men or people themselves, right?
Right. And, you notice that the one thing that they still haven't done, although there's talk of it with the technology advancing, is take the judgment away from the home plate umpire. He's still the, you know, the demigod on the field who decides whether it's a strike or a ball.
Why do philosophers like baseball so much? And I guess that's one of the first questions I thought about asking you when I first started the book. But then as I read the book, I realize that the wisdom of baseball can explain a lot of things.
Yeah, I think so. There are two main things, it seems to me. One is the structure of the game itself. So the fact that there are so many pauses and without the clock, the chronological clock inside, you're into a different experience of time. And so I think it naturally inclines us to reflection, even if it's not really always philosophical reflection. And then wonderful, you know, explosions into riveting action. But the other thing is that the kinds of things that go on in the game, you know, I was talking about failure, but even to go back to trying, for example, you know, the very idea of what it is to try. And I talk about how this has been a theme in Asian philosophy for thousands of years. You know, how do you achieve without trying? Trying can become the enemy of success if you try too hard. So baseball coaches will, even without having read the Tao Te Ching, will say things like try easier, you know, mm-hmm. Try not to try. And then some of the humorous things, Stephen Potter's funny books about one-upmanship, I quote them towards the end, and he had all these little tricks about what he called breaking the flow, because conscious flow is broken flow. So if you call attention to your opponent's actions, that can be exactly the wrong thing for them, because now once their conscious mind is engaged, the semi-conscious, or let's call it the second nature mind, is no longer able to execute. And so Aristotle talks about this too. It's not just in the ancient tradition. So, I mean, it's just naturally things happening in the game that seem to reward that sort of thought.
What have you learned about people and character from the game of baseball?
Yeah. Well, that relates to Aristotle, too, as it happens. He is the great ethical philosopher of character, and how character is dynamically related to virtue. And here's one thing, again, something that doesn't seem obviously philosophical at first, but I think is when you're trying to learn how to do something, so to execute with excellence, what you do in baseball, as in so many other things, is practice. Practice, practice, practice. And so what you want to get to is a point at which when the ball comes at you at shortstop, you don't think about it. And coaches will often say things like, don't think too much out there. Because what you want is for your training, your body and your mind, it's not just your muscle memory, it's your whole self, to respond in a successful way and fire that ball over to first. So character in that sense, it's not so much ethical character in the being a good person,
yeah,
but rather character in having certain particular traits that allow you to do excellent things.
And so does that translate to, or does that carry over to how fans are? And I'd like you to compare, say, football fans to, say, baseball fans, or hockey fans to baseball fans.
Yeah, well, it's a pretty big topic, but I do have a couple of critical things to say about baseball fans, especially here in Toronto, who seem more and more to be engaging in the spectacle in a sort of hockey-style way, with loving fights and
yeah,
things like that. And there's nothing wrong with fighting in baseball, although it's rarely conclusive, but it's not obviously like hockey, where fighting is folded into the norms of the game. Baseball, for purists anyway, and I guess I consider myself one, baseball is about the grace of the play and the strength and power of the players. And so I want to see that. I want to see displays of that, and I want to appreciate that. I don't want to boo the umpire. Go ahead and boo the umpire. Every fan's right. But it really disturbs me when I see fans booing their hometown players,
yeah,
which is actually, well, I don't know about NHL hockey, but it's certainly fairly common in minor hockey. It used to happen all the time when I lived in New Haven and the Nighthawks were playing there. In fact, that was the sport. The sport was to go and boo your hometown players. It didn't matter who they were playing. It seems a perverse way to engage in a spectacle to me.
It is America's pastime, and you write about Canada's unique relationship to it. And in particular, you write in the book about how Canadians feel about the Toronto Blue Jays, and especially Canadians outside of Toronto.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing to me. And I way back in '93, in fact, I started thinking about this after '92, but especially after '93, I gave a paper at a conference, and I argued that the Blue Jays were a truly national team. There was some skepticism, I have to say, among the people there, Canadian and American, that this could be the case, because A, it's not hockey.
Yeah.
B, people hate Toronto. C, it's a huge country. How do you really imagine that a fan in St. John's and a fan in Victoria are both cheering for the same team? And yet, I think it's more true now than ever. You see people going down, you mentioned Safeco, people go down to Seattle, to Cleveland, to Detroit, and there's sometimes more Jays fans in the house than local fans. And they come from all over. They're, on the prairies, they love baseball. They've played baseball there for, decades and decades. And the Jays are the country's team. It's too bad that we don't have another professional team. That would be nice. That was the team that I grew up watching because, I wasn't, until 77 anyway,
mm-hmm.
I switched over. So yes, I do think there is such a thing as Canada's national team, and I think given that it's the only non-American team in the major leagues, it does accentuate all of those dynamics, whether you like them or not, about Canada-U.S. identity politics and all the little things, the insult swapping and the smugness and the arrogance, all those narratives come into play. And, I suppose you can get tired of them, but they're there. There's no question in my mind.
What's it like when you watch, say, other countries, when they play baseball? I mean, does it have the same sort of, does it stir the same feelings for you?
Well, a couple of things occur to me. One is, it's sort of curious in a way that professional sports have been associated with cities, since amateur sports typically have been associated with universities and colleges, in at least most of the major sports. So the city itself becomes almost a country unto itself. That's fascinating. It's clearly true in big cities like New York and Chicago. But then when you talk about actual other nations like Cuba, like the Dominican, Japan, and now with the World Baseball Classic, which I'm surprised to find it's really popular among my younger friends,
yeah,
who are baseball fans.
Mm-hmm.
I thought always it was a bit goofy. But I think this year, for the first time, I took their point. It's kind of great to see teams from all over the world playing against each other at a pretty high level. So the globalization of baseball has been very interesting. And we haven't seen more than just the first bits of that yet. The league is already way more multinational, multicultural than it was 20 years ago. But I think there's going to be even more of that coming.
You know, baseball says a lot about America and Americans. So how might baseball explain how Donald Trump became president?
Well, I guess anybody who knows the kind of writing I do won't be surprised that Donald Trump is mentioned in the book, and not in a flattering way. I wrote a piece of in the run-up to the election, so he was still candidate Trump at the time, and I'm sure people will recall that he refused to say whether he would accept the results of the election until he knew whether he'd won. And the sports fan and the philosopher in me was outraged by this piece of brazenness, as with so many others,
mm-hmm.
Because it's just so antithetical to the very idea of a contest and of trying and failing and all the things that I care about. Because you have to be committed to the outcome of the game, even if it goes against you, to be genuinely engaged in it. Otherwise, you're doing something else. You're being strategic, or you're lying, or there's something else going on. You're not playing the game. And that to me is a significant ethical flaw, to take that position on a contest in which you appear to be engaged. So baseball doesn't explain Mr. Trump, but Mr. Trump, in a way, highlights what's good about baseball, because nobody can say, well, I'm not going to accept the results of this game unless I win. That's bizarre. I think that's probably all I should say about the Trump presidency at this point.
Well, what are you looking forward to in this upcoming season of a baseball game? We're just starting the last week or so.
Yeah. Well, it would be nice if the Blue Jays could win some games. off to a fairly disastrous road swing. I was telling somebody a story. I was watching, I think it was SportsCenter, and these two analysts were on, and they were talking about this 1-5 start, and one of them said very seriously to the other one, "Do you think it's time to panic?" And then the other guy replied just as seriously, no, it's too early to panic, but soon. And I thought, that's the voice of the baseball fan. But, you know, it's true that if you have a bad April, that can really keep you in the doldrums for the rest of the season. Everyone thinks, well, it's a game you play almost every day. There's 162 regular season games. You can always come back. Well, sure, you can, but if you get off to a bad start, and your head is below 500, you can be in a lot of trouble. So you should never panic, but panic is bad for the excellence, but it's time to be concerned.
Yeah.
I'm also looking forward to, I guess, I don't think the Cubs are going to repeat. I'm looking forward to seeing some pushback on the, you mentioned the speeding up rules and changes that are coming. But I don't know how confident I am in that, because the fan base of the game is maybe changing. Mostly, I'm just looking forward to getting out to the park on a warm day and having a sandwich and a beer.
Yeah, I don't really watch baseball. Like, I'm not a fan, say, but I understand the game, and I've grown up with it because my grandmother was a huge fan of baseball, and so we all had to watch it growing up. But I did see a game the other night, and they had the on TV in the batter's box the square superimposed on the player so that you could see where the strike zone was?
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, the one thing I do like about watching baseball on TV is having that superimposed strike zone. Maybe that sounds odd, because I like to see how good or bad the umpire's call is.
Mm.
And also how good the catcher is at Russell Martin of the Blue Jays is great at pulling the ball that's actually outside the zone back towards it to sort of fool the umpire.
Mm.
So you can only really see nuances like that if you have the superimposed square. I don't know. I would very much dislike it if we went so far with this kind of technological immersion thing as to have automatic ball and strike calls. I think those subtleties have to be predicated on the human judgment part, and you know, the players the pitcher has to imagine where the strike zone is. He can't see it. It's a notional rectangle, and the batter is creating it with his body in part. So that to me is pretty fascinating, and I hope that never changes.
Now, I mentioned it off the top or near the top that this was a personal book to write, and I have to say that in some parts it's read like a memoir. Is that something that you're thinking about doing anytime soon?
Well, I've used some narrative things in a couple of my books. This one and a book I wrote some time ago about fishing, my fishing, which has a bunch of scenes in British Columbia. I don't think I have lived a sufficiently interesting life to write an actual memoir. I just like having the stories in there. The narrative elements, to me, are what ground these thoughts in a lived reality. And I know that readers, I'm one of them, I like to read argument, but I also like to read stories and to feel like I'm getting to know a writer through his or her stories. So that's where I am currently. And in some ways, this baseball book is sort of a follow-up or a companion to my fly fishing book, which is called Catch and Release.
Yeah.
I don't know that I have a lot more to say in terms of my personal interest in this way, but who knows? I don't want to make any predictions.
It's a very interesting book, and in some parts very beautiful, and I appreciate your time today. It's nice talking again. Congratulations, and continued good luck with this book, Mark.
Thank you very much, Joe. I really appreciate it.
The book is called Fail Better, Why Baseball Matters. It's published by Biblioasis. Its author, Mark Kingwell, joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunton.